Chapter 3 is where I'm at in my Bible this
morning. I want to invite you to do the same. Daniel chapter 3 is where we're going to spend our time together this morning. And while you're finding Daniel chapter 3, I'll express my thankfulness for you this morning. I'm glad to be with you and able to worship God together. It's always one of the high points of my week to see the people of God gathered in this place, to be together as brethren and family, and to prepare ourselves for God's eternal presence even as we worship Him. I'm glad that you are here this morning, and we've got visitors among us, as we often do. We're glad that you're here as well this morning, and we hope that you'll share yourself with us before you leave this morning. Stick around, talk a little bit, reach out to us as we reach out to you, and especially if there's a spiritual concern that's on your mind this morning, that's why you're here. Talk to somebody before you leave this morning. We'd like to do what we can to help you know God better and to get right with Him, but we're glad that you are here this morning. Book of Daniel chapter 3. I want to begin reading the very beginning of the story, chapter 3, beginning of verse 1. Let's enter into this story. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits, and he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, judges, magistrates, all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And so the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then a herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, all the peoples and nations of men of every language fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. All right, let's stop right there. Daniel chapter 3. So here we have a story from Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Daniel himself will not appear in this story, but his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or as we know them better by their Babylonian-given pagan names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, will be challenged in this story. I want to start this morning with this story by setting the context here a little bit. This story follows chapter 2. In chapter 2, you remember the story, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and that dream is an image. That image has a head of gold, a chest of silver, thighs or legs of bronze, and then feet of iron, or lower legs of iron with feet mixed with iron and clay. And Daniel reveals the interpretation to Nebuchadnezzar. God has given him this dream. And in this dream, the point is that God is going to basically lead history to its conclusion, so to speak. The head of gold is the Babylonian Empire, Nebuchadnezzar. The chest of silver is the Persian Empire that God will eventually allow to conquer the Babylonians. The upper legs of bronze are the Greeks, whom God will eventually allow to conquer the Persians. And then at the bottom is the iron Romans, who will conquer them all. And in the days of those kings, the days of the Romans, God tells Nebuchadnezzar, and the days of the Romans, and days of that fourth kingdom, I will establish a kingdom that will never fall. In fact, in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, that kingdom, God's eternal kingdom, is represented by a stone cut without hands. In other words, God makes it. It's not of human doing. And that stone crushes the feet of the image, and the whole image is turned to dust, basically collapses. In other words, God's kingdom conquers all kingdoms of man. And so the dream that God gave Nebuchadnezzar was basically telling him, your kingdom's not going to last, but for whatever it's worth, if there's any consolation, the kingdom after you is not going to last either. No kingdom of man lasts, in fact. The only kingdom that lasts, the kingdom that will eventually prevail over all human kingdoms, whether it's gold, silver, bronze, or iron, or whatever comes after the Romans, today we'd say the United States of America, whatever kingdom of men comes afterwards, kingdoms of men always fail in the end. One rises, one falls. Its successor rises, that one falls. The only kingdom that prevails is the kingdom of God. And that's the dream that God gives Nebuchadnezzar. Isn't it interesting when you turn the page to chapter 3, then connect the dots with me here this morning? Isn't it interesting when you turn to chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar having been told, your head of gold, your kingdom will be succeeded. Nebuchadnezzar chooses to build an image and make it all of gold. Where do you think he got the idea of building an image and saying everybody's got to worship this image all of gold? It's hard when you read the book of Daniel in context. It's hard not to sit there and say, I wonder what Nebuchadnezzar's thinking when, just out of the blue, he builds an image all of gold and says, everybody in my empire's got to worship this. It's like a team-building exercise for pagans, folks. Let's get everybody, thanks for the heads up, God, that apparently my kingdom could fall. I'm going to get everybody to say, we're never going to let this thing fall. An image all of gold, and everybody worships it, or else there's going to be fire. Everybody worships an image all of gold, or else. Think about that. In one sense, it's a form of defiance. In one sense, it's a form of Nebuchadnezzar still being a pagan. He knows there's something different about Daniel and Daniel's God, but it doesn't mean that Nebuchadnezzar still doesn't think like a pagan. He still doesn't think like a polytheist. All right, so this God, whom I've beaten in battle, by the way, because I've taken their city, I've taken their God's temple stuff, their God can't be that strong. Maybe he's just smart but weak, like those bookworms we all knew in high school. Good for tests, but not good on the sports field. Maybe that's their God. He knows what's going on, but he's really not very powerful to enforce it because I've got their God's people and their God's stuff, and I destroyed their God's city. He thinks that I could possibly fall. Well, let's make sure that, first of all, everybody understands Babylon will never fall. Let's build an image of gold, and everybody worships it or else. And so we have here the herald calling. And I want you to notice that in verse 2, it starts with the leaders of Babylon. All these different satraps and prefects and governors and counselors and treasurers and judges and magistrates and all the rulers of the provinces are brought to worship this image all of gold. In other words, the entire bureaucratic apparatus of the Babylonian Empire is brought to worship. There's to make sure that everybody who works for me is on board. Yeah, ever have that happen at work, especially if you work for a big corporation? You ever have these kind of situations where everybody's supposed to come and show loyalty to the vision and to the leader and to the executives? Everybody gets called into corporate sometimes. Everybody gets taken on retreat because everybody's supposed to come in and show that we are loyal to the leader and the vision and the company. That's kind of what's going on here. Everybody's supposed to come in, and everybody's going to bow down. And you sit there and you look at verse 3, and it seems kind of redundant. You know, here we go again. So the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, the rulers of the provinces were assembled. The point is, everybody came. Everybody who's anybody came. This was an all-hands-on-deck kind of meeting in Nebuchadnezzar's world. And so they come, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then the herald loudly proclaims. But I want you to notice how the herald phrases what's said. Oh, peoples, nations, and men of every language. There's a universality to what's going on here. It may be technically the leaders of the Babylonian bureaucracy that have been summoned. You know, all the mid-level, lower level, upper level. This is our once-a-year corporate retreat kind of moment. Everybody who's in leadership, everybody who's involved in running this thing is called in to show loyalty to the image of gold that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. But what the herald says is important. Now, this is seen as kind of the human rebellion, so to speak, against God. Oh, that's not what the herald means when he says it, but it's all men of every place and language. It's the human race, so to speak, gathered here to worship the kingdom of man in rebellion against the kingdom of God, which the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had told him was going to prevail over any and all kingdoms of men. It's Babel, folks. Literally, it's Babylon, but it's Babel. It's Genesis chapter 11. It's everybody gathered together to rebel against God. To say, no, God, the pattern that you've established for history and the story you want to write and tell is not what we're going to do. We're going to bow down to the image all of gold. Or else. And so here's Nebuchadnezzar, who's leading, in a sense, the human race. If you look at the language and look at the carefully, what's being said here. It's Nebuchadnezzar wanting to make it all about him and all about his accomplishments and all about his power and his country and what he's done. And if you doubt that, just turn the page to chapter 4 when Nebuchadnezzar will say, is this not Babylon, Babylon the Great, which I have built? It's all about him. He wants to challenge God's view of history and God's plans for the future, and he demands that everybody who's anybody come in and join him in this team-building exercise of rebellion against God. And so that's the scene, and that's the situation. That brings us to verse 8. Let's read a little bit more. And so beginning in verse 8, for this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. See, because what happened? This overwhelming sound, this overwhelming music was played, and everybody bowed down. The human race did it, except for these three guys. For that reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, an unmistakable sound. It's not like that Muzak in the elevators where you kind of, oh, was that playing? No, this is one of those, you know, the orchestra strikes the opening note of Beethoven's Symphony No. 9. You know this has been played and begun. They were supposed to fall down and worship, into verse 10. Verse 11, but they remind Nebuchadnezzar, but whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. And so Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I want you to underscore those words, in rage and in anger. It's never fun to stand up. And they do it passively. It's not that they were directly confronting Nebuchadnezzar. They simply did not participate. It's never fun. It's never enjoyable. It's never pleasant to be the only one not doing wrong and being noticed for it. They did not provoke a confrontation with Nebuchadnezzar over this. They just simply did not do wrong. And Nebuchadnezzar is outraged and angry. Can you imagine what that would have been like if that had been your boss in his office? I mean, you get the idea. Because, folks, this story hits where we live, especially in a dark, dying, decaying age. Being called to HR. Being called to your boss's office. Because the way you live and who you are, and sometimes something as simple as the fact that you do not participate in certain events in the month of June in the corporate world anymore, makes you stand out because you did not bow down. In a rage and anger, he gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded, and he said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, now again, look at what he's saying. He's not saying you can't go to church on Sunday. He's not saying you can't worship your own gods on your own time when it's not company time. What he's saying is, on company time, you do what we say or else. You worship what we worship. You bow where we bow or else. If you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hand? And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king. Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to give you an answer concerning this matter. In other words, we don't need time to think this over, sleep on it, or consult with our attorneys about what our rights are in this situation. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the fire, or the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we're not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. This central part of the story is fascinating, folks. You got a large crowd. You got a large crowd. On one level, and a crowd that large where you've got everybody who's everybody in Babylon gathered together for this corporate retreat. You would think that in a crowd that large, three people would be easily overlooked on the one hand. And in one sense, they are. The only reason they're caught is because they're ratted out. I want you to notice that. They're ratted out. Because, folks, when the people who are closest to you, that you work with, that you live among, perhaps sometimes it's even your own unbelieving family members, but when those who are closest to you are offended by the fact that you do not do as they do, you do not participate in the world the way they participate in it, that you are not a right-thinking person who goes with the flow, there are going to be people who can't just leave it alone, even in this age of tolerance. They're going to rat you out. They're going to call the authorities. They're going to point you out. They're going to try to get you in trouble. That's what they were doing with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They wanted them dead. If you know what the penalty is, why would you rat those three guys out? You want to see them burn. They were not hated for what they did, folks. They were hated for what they would not do. And we need to understand, in an age of so-called tolerance, that's as often as much what we can become guilty of in the eyes of the world. It's not what we do. It's what we will not do. It's what we will not affirm. It's what we will not say. It's when we will not bow that the world becomes, to use the words the text uses of Nebuchadnezzar, angry, outraged, furious. Not because of what we do, but because of what we will not do. And so not only have to take on the king, they have to take on the crowd as well. Everybody has it out for them, so to speak. They were probably being watched. I mean, after all, chapter 1, how do we even first meet these three young men along with their friend Daniel? These are the guys who won't eat what everybody else is eating. Again, notice in the story, in the book of Daniel, this is about life in a world that is Babylon like still today. They get in trouble not for what they do, but for what they will not do. Daniel's friends will not defile themselves with the king's food. They will not go along with this. They will not participate with this. Now, the story works out well enough for them in chapter 1, but I'm sure that establishes a reputation. These Jews don't think like everybody else thinks. They don't go with the flow. They don't go along with what everybody else is doing. They're probably being watched as Jews who don't conform already. Listen, folks, and especially young people who are growing up in a dark and twisted age, you got to understand something. When people know that you serve another God and that you live by a different standard, that you do not fully participate in the culture that they participate in, that you claim to be striving for righteousness and holiness, that you go to church, then you're naturally going to be watched. Some people are going to naturally assume you're self-righteous. Some people are going to naturally assume you're a hypocrite because, after all, in our culture, so many religious people who claim, or at least claim to be religious, are. They're going to look and they're going to watch. Because at the end of the day, if nothing else, what they can't stand about you, and young people, you got to understand this is how the world works. Your attempts to do what's right remind them of the fact that they are not doing right. Your very presence and the fact that you don't participate is, in one sense, an indictment of who they are and what they are doing. Now, on the same token, on the same page, understand this, and young people hear this as well. And therefore, when you are known as a Christian, whenever you do act hypocritically, whenever you do violate that commitment, people are going to call you on it. They're going to throw it back at you. It can be some conversation at the office, something said in the locker room, something said in the hallway at school, adults and young people. Some word, some phrase, some joke slips down, and somebody says, "Hey, I thought you were a Christian. You're just like us." And so here we are in verse 8, and they're ratted out. They're watched. People have it out for them, not because of what they do, but because of what they will not do. People who claim to have ultimate truth, people who claim to know the one and only true God, people who claim that there is only one way to be saved and live forever, are always a threat to any culture, any authority, because at the end of the day, people who claim there's only one way and there's only one God affirm that there's only one authority that really matters in life. And it's not your boss, it's not your company, it's not your school, it's not your degree, it's not your country or your rulers. So when you take a stand for God, the world's going to try to tear you down for it. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have great positions after chapter 2 when Daniel and his friends are elevated for interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream, but everyone has to show up on the plain of Dura, and so everybody does. They do as well. I imagine, what must have been the conversation in the carpool that day for the three of them? Hey, you know what this meeting's about? Once they get there, boy, I'm glad I'm with you two guys. Maybe they're saying, hey, where's Daniel? Oh, that's why he called in sick today. Okay. And so they get in the moment. Can you imagine the pressure they were under? We feel pressure when we are just risking our jobs or risking our relationships. They're in a situation where you don't do this, you die. And you don't just die. Burned alive. There are a lot better ways to die if you're going to die. Can you imagine what that must have been like, standing there when the music starts to play? And everybody in that multitude, everybody bows down. Everybody bows down. But you and the guy on your right and the guy on your left. You want to talk about peer pressure? Think about how they could have compromised. Think about how they could have compromised in that moment if they had wanted to. They could say, you know what, we're going to bow too, but when we bow, we're going to pray to God the whole time. We're going to make this spiritually redemptive. We're going to pray to God while we bow, because we know an idol's nothing. We can rationalize this, guys. We can be a team player. We're going to bow, but we're going to pray to God. We're doing spiritual stuff. We bow when we pray anyway, so we'll just make it about us, and we'll pray to God while we bow, because we know an idol's nothing. The problem is they know what's going on in their heads and hearts, but what message are they sending to everybody else in that room or that crowd who sees them? That they're affirming Babylon. That they're bowing to the image because for the same reason that everybody else is bowing to the image. Well, they could have tried to rationalize if they wanted to. See, people can't tell we serve a different sort of God when there is nothing culturally distinct about us. When we act the way everybody else is acting, regardless of what we say is in my heart. Well, God knows my heart. I've had people say that before to me over the years. Well, God knows my heart. Yeah, but your life says you're of the world. In the crowd, at work, in our families, if people cannot discern that there's a different sort of God at work in our lives, because we will stand when we pray if everybody else is bowing, because we don't want anybody to be confused about what we're doing. This is a story, folks, when literally everybody else is doing it. Look at the language. All people, every language. That verse 3 is important. All people, or the herald's cry, rather. All people of every language were there, verse 4. Here's how we as adults, by the way, we sometimes use the same line of reasoning and rationalization that we don't accept from our teenager. Because after all, when our teenager says to us, well, everybody else is doing it, Mom, everybody else is doing it, Dad, we shoot them down right then and there, don't we? But see, but as adults, sometimes we get into this temptation as well. We'll say phrases like, well, that's just the way it's done here. Or we'll say, you know, that's just business. Or we'll say, that's how business gets done or how we do it in this corporation. Or we'll use some euphemism. We call it standard operating procedures. Because we rationalize, that's how you survive, that's how you get ahead. God wouldn't want me to lose my job. God wouldn't want me to be kicked out of school. God would not want me to pay any consequences, heaven forbid, for being his person. Oh, but I'm still a Christian. But here are three people who say, we're in your kingdom, but we're not of your kingdom. We're not going to bow and say, well, we're praying to our God, you pray to your God. We're all, you know, we all look the same. They understood what the message was going to be sent if they bowed and they would not bow. Or they could have rationalized it this way. They could have rationalized it this way. The conversation could have been, well, you know, our God has protected us so far. We're doing great things for him. We're as high up officials of Babylon. We've survived being taken captive. We've gotten a world-class education in chapter 1. We've been given good jobs. Surely God wouldn't have brought us this far and protected us this long just to have us throw it all away, just to have us burned up. Surely God's got bigger plans for us than taking a stand for him and paying the price. That doesn't sound like our God. And so we fudge because somehow God never wants us to suffer for doing what's right. And we find a way to compromise and rationalize in our own head. And so the way the story could have gone was right as the music starts to play, oh, look, my shoelace is untied for 20 minutes. Or until the song's over. Because isn't that what we do as adults even? When the pressure's on and everybody bows. But we don't want to pay the price of standing up. But here they are. They were willing to be identified. They were willing to be branded as different. They were willing to be noticed. They were willing to be called difficult. They were willing to be called not a team player. They were willing to be called hateful. They were willing to let Nebuchadnezzar be angry at them if he was angry at them for the right kinds of reasons. They were willing to be acknowledged as outsiders. These are Jews, the report comes back about them. They were willing to be considered ignorant. They were willing to be looked at as just plain stupid for what they were willing to give up and sacrifice, because in Babylon, everybody wants their job. Everyone wants a better job. Everyone wants more money and more standing. And here they are throwing everything away, perhaps even their very lives. And so when it comes to you and I today, when the rubber meets the road, you want to see if you're bowing down to the culture's God, to the culture's idols or not. Look at how you spend, for instance, your time or your money. Those are things that show where our allegiances are. Where do you give the most of your time and your money? Are you always too busy to help and serve in the church? But you've got plenty of time for sports, activities, extra shifts, overtime. Where do you spend your money? Time and money show where our gods are. But perhaps in this day and age, as much as anything, what also shows where God is, what are we unwilling to lose? Again, job, status, station, situation, relationship. What is it that we're unwilling to lose? We serve the gods of reputation and ego. That's one of our gods today. We bow to success. We hold on to our positions, our money, our authority, the applause, the attention that we get. And so we'll sacrifice home, church, service, our integrity, and even our souls. Because we forget that no matter what Nebuchadnezzar wants to, he can build an image all of gold if he wants to. But that dream is what that dream is. God has spoken, and that image will fade to silver, and then the bronze, and then the iron, and it will be destroyed in the end. And so you get in this story here to Nebuchadnezzar, who's outraged and probably embarrassed, because after all, nobody ever likes to be shown up by three guys who won't do what everybody else is doing. It makes you look like you're weak and you don't have authority over your people when you've got somebody thinking for themselves. And so these three stand up. And Nebuchadnezzar arrogantly says, "What God can rescue you?" But what's so important, and I want you to see this as well this morning and what they say, ladies and gentlemen, to Nebuchadnezzar's boast and brag that there basically is no God who can save you from my anger. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, besides in verse 16 saying we don't need time to think it over, verse 17, this is important. You need to see this with your eyes this morning. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us. Yeah, our God is powerful to do this, but here's the important part. Verse 18. This is what you need to see. And young people, you need to see this as well this morning. You need to hear this. You need to understand this. Verse 18, what they say. But even if he does not what? Save us. See, we always read this story and we think about the happy ending because we know what's going to happen. When they have to make a decision, they don't know what's going to happen. They do not know whether God will deliver or not. Sometimes God does. Sometimes God doesn't. So why are they making the decision? Because they're God-fearing people and God always delivers his people? No, that's not why they're making their decision. They're making their decision because it's the right thing to do. They're making their choice not based upon an assured outcome. They won't die. They won't lose their job. They won't not get into that college or university or graduate program. They're not making their decision because they're assured of some earthly happy ending. They're making their decision because they fear God and they're going to do what's right no matter what. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve you or your gods or worship the image that you have set up. They know what they're going to do, and they're going to do it no matter what. Because they're not living for the moment, they're living for Babylon. They don't value what Babylon values. Babylon values wealth, Babylon values status, Babylon values education. Babylon values power, Babylon values life. And they value none of this. What they value is God and God's ways, God's glory, and God's name. They live by a logic that you won't learn in Babylon, and that Babylon will not understand when you live by that logic. God is as real to them as what they can see, hear, and even feel, then and there. Fear, ladies and gentlemen, understand this, and young people need to hear me as well. Fear cannot dictate our obedience to God. What seems best for us personally cannot dictate whether or not we're going to obey and do what God says no matter what. Because if Babylon is temporary, so is the suffering that Babylon can inflict. The worst that the world can do to us does not last. As Jesus put it in the Gospels, don't fear the man who can only kill the body and has nothing more he can do. Fear the one who has power to cast soul and body into hell. That's who you should fear. The worst they can do is kill you, but you know what? I serve a God who gives life to the dead. I'm not worried about that. If that's the worst they can do, they have no power over us because God reverses that. If that's the worst they can do, they have no power because my God is a God of life. And so at the end of the day, you know the end of the story. you know what happens. God does deliver. Maybe perhaps not even maybe so much to reward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Maybe it's really just to make the point of Nebuchadnezzar. He was the one who blasphemously said, what God can deliver you? God says, I accept that challenge. Game on. You throw them in, crank up the heat. I'll go in there with them as the fourth person. They'll come out in a while. Not a problem for me. I made fire. This is an exception story, folks. The happy ending. It's not a get-rich-quick, stand for God, and you're going to get rewarded. Everything always works out. That's not the application of this story. God had the point to make to Nebuchadnezzar. He made it through Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The point of the story is not that there's always a happy ending in this life. The point of the story is you stand for God no matter what. It's funny, by the time you get to verse 28, even Nebuchadnezzar gets that. Verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar responded and he said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who put their trust in him. See, Nebuchadnezzar learned who their real God, what their real source of authority and importance in life is. Who sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I make it a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb. He was a great motivational leader, don't you think? And their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other god who is able to deliver in this way. And Nebuchadnezzar's fickle and worldly. It won't last long. Turn the page, he's back at it again. But maybe that's why God delivered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Not as a reward for them, as a reward for them, listen to me, but for the sake of his name. That's how God works ultimately. Our reward will never be found here, even in deliverance, even in blessing. Our reward is to know God, to live with him forever. That's the reward. You'll never find that here and now. This is not a get-rich-quick, stand-for-God-and-God-will-always-get-you-out-of-trouble story. This is an exception story. You stand for God no matter what. God can save from anything. Sure, absolutely. I have faith, and you have faith too. But notice what Nebuchadnezzar says. He uses an important word in what he says about what he knows about these men. They trusted in God. They didn't know whether they were going to live or whether they were going to die when they threw them in. They just trusted that no matter what, they were doing what's right and leave how it all turns out to God. Three quick observations and we're done. This is a story about compromise versus commitment. And that's one way to frame it. That's one way to think about it. The big word, the Bible word that we need, that we often have lost sight of even in the church, is the word holiness. Set apart. Three men standing alone. Against everybody they know, everybody they work with, standing alone in the crowd when everybody else bows down and life itself is on the line, standing up alone, set apart, setting themselves apart by how they live and the fact that they will not participate. And they're noticed for it and punished for it. And again, part of what this story underscores, young people understand this, it's you don't just stand apart from the world by what you do. The nice things, the good things. You stand apart by what you will not do, where you will not go, what you will not say, what you will not laugh at, what you will not look at on the internet. Christianity is a call to be holy, to be set apart from the world no matter what. And so Jesus once put it this way in the Sermon on the Mount, the essence of his kingdom. Matthew chapter 5, beginning verse 11. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand and give light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your God who is in heaven, which is exactly how Daniel chapter 3 ends. And as for Jesus who spoke those words, he goes out and he lives that. And he goes out and he lives that and he dies for that. If you are holy, you will live a life that demands an explanation. And they will hate you for it. I think this is why God doesn't just take us to heaven when we're saved. Why does God, you ever wonder, why does God leave us in the world? I obey the gospel, okay, I've chosen God. Why do you just take me straight to heaven? Why do I have to stay here for another 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years? For the same reason Daniel had to stay in Babylon all those decades and never got to go home. As God's witness to the world, as a living embodiment of his teaching, as salt and light in the midst of a dying age. So at the end of the day, God's name will be glorified when people are forced to admit, if not now, then certainly at the last day, not just was God right, but his people were right. And I was wrong. Holiness means you're set apart. And folks, in this dark and declining age, when we are more and more pushed and encouraged, whether it's at school or at work and by HR, to affirm things that we ought not affirm, to show ourselves as allies of some of the worst of human depravity, we're going to have to make choices as the years go by more and more. Young people, you have to think carefully about the careers you choose and the companies you work for. Because of certain months in the year when you're going to be pressured to bow the knee to the image of man. It's called pride. There's pride in all the wrong and ungodly things of this age. And you're going to have to make a choice. Some of us are already having to make choices in where we work and who we associate with. So we need to be holy. We need to stand up when everybody else is bowing down, and we need to bow down when everybody else is standing up. We need to be holy, not to be obnoxious, to be different for its own sake, but we will not affirm what the world calls normal or healthy or love. Which reminds us really the big picture, what it's really about then is, are you part of God's plan or are you fighting God's plan? That's what Nebuchadnezzar in one sense was doing, isn't it? I mean, that's what he's doing. He builds a statue all of gold. No, God's plan for history is not going to turn out. My kingdom's the one that everybody should be loyal to. It's all about me and what I'm doing. Nebuchadnezzar did that at the global level, but we do that in our own lives all the time. God's purpose is that his people bear witness to his truth, live lives that demand an explanation, suffer righteously and loyally and trustingly to him the consequences of being holy in a fallen world, and wait for him to bring vengeance, deliverance, justice, and life. I'll tell you, if you're tempted to compromise, if you're tempted to bow in whatever facet of your life that exists for you, you're fighting God's plan and God's purpose. And if you're not careful, you may find yourself on the wrong side of God's judgment in the last day. Because you're either on board with what he's doing in history and where it's headed, or you're not. And those with ears to hear need to think about that. And so where it really gets personal is, what in your life tempts you to compromise your holiness? What is it in your life you're keeping from God? What is it in your life that you would not lose under any circumstances, that you just can't imagine giving up? Is it your job or your career? Is it that relationship? Is it good old-fashioned money and greed? Sports? What is it in your life? All of us struggle with something, because idolatry is the quintessential human sin. We may not build a little image to bow down to, but all of us have things that we would choose over God, push come to shove. God knows what they are, so does Satan. And all of us need to be examining our lives and seeing where we wrestle with saying yes to God and no to whatever it is. It's about being holy, it's about resisting compromise. In our age, I do think it will get harder. And we need to think about that, prepare ourselves now. Like Daniel and his friends, set your heart now. Determine that you will not defile yourself, whatever it may be, whatever the cost may be. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whether he delivers or not, we won't bow. You can do what you need to do right now. We're not wasting more time. Get on with it. We know who we are. We know who we serve. And that's all that matters. You need to get your life right with God this morning by joining the kingdom that will never fall, the kingdom that will crush all others in the end. We'll be happy to help you with that. If you're ready to confess Jesus as Lord, Savior, Son of God, and King, repenting of your sins, we'll baptize you for the forgiveness of your sins. You're here this morning, you're a child of God already, but you have compromised in some way. In the metaphorical assembly of the nations, you have bowed to an image in how you've been living. And you know that, and God knows that. Maybe even some of the brethren know about that. Pray to God for however you have compromised your holiness, you're being set apart to Him in His ways. We can pray with you, for you, encourage you in some way. We can hold you accountable to what's tempting you to bow. Why don't you come and talk to us right now while we stand.